Imagine this scenario. An outpatient clinic, you see one of your long-term patients, who is a 29-year-old woman, for an annual checkup. She is noticeably fatigued and appears downcast. She tells you that over the past few weeks, she has been feeling sad, although she cannot identify anything in her life that seems to specifically bring on that feeling. Additionally, she feels guilty about feeling sad, is zoning out at work, and tells you that she would rather sit on the couch at home instead of going out with friends. On further questioning, you find out that she is also sleeping and eating poorly. Her physical exam is normal. You consider the causes of this patient's recent change in mood and outlook, and how it has impacted her health. Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Yoon Weisholtz, here today to bring another episode in psychiatry from our bricks to your ears. After listening to this episode, you will be able to 1. Describe the etiology and epidemiology of depressive disorders. 2. Compare and contrast the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for depressive disorders. 3. List the common differential diagnoses and comorbid conditions for depressive disorders. And 4. Describe the evidence-based assessments and treatment approaches for depressive disorders. Part 1. What are depressive disorders? First off, and I promise that I'm not trying to scare you off right at the beginning of our episode, but the list of what comprises depressive disorders is pretty darn long. Depressive disorders include major depressive disorder, persistent depressive disorder, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, substance or medication-induced depressive disorder, depressive disorder due to another medical condition, other specified depressive disorder, and unspecified depressive disorder. Are you still there with me? Whew, good. Now that I rattled off this long list, we'll talk about the specifics of each disorder type later on. For now, let's focus on the big picture. What do all of these disorders have in common? All of these disorders present with persistent sad, empty, or irrational feelings, accompanied by changes that have a significant negative effect on daily function. This is an incredibly important theme, so I want to emphasize it by quizzing you. Ready? What is the underlying feature of depressive disorders? All depressive disorders are characterized by persistent, sad, empty, or irrational feelings that significantly impair a person's daily life. Part 2. How common are depressive disorders? Unfortunately, depressive disorders are fairly common. In fact, chances are you may know someone who has experienced depression. In the United States, the lifetime prevalence of major depressive disorder is 17%. Now, I don't want to throw statistics at you, but I want to emphasize these numbers to show you just how prevalent depressive disorders are in our society, and therefore their importance in being diagnosed and treated. The U.S. lifetime prevalence of major depression is 18% for the white population and 10% among the African American population. However, major depression is more chronic and leads to more impairment in African Americans. What about the risk of depression across age groups? Well, it's been found that depression is less common in older adults than in younger adults and declines with advancing age. One survey found that the 12-month prevalence of major depression was about 10% in 18 to 34-year-olds and roughly 3% in those older than 65 years. However, older adults with other medical problems are at increased risk of depression compared with those in the general community. Now, this isn't a math quiz, but let's review a key statistic. What is the lifetime prevalence of depressive disorders in the United States? It's 17%. That means almost one out of every five individuals. Part 3. What causes depressive disorders? That's a million, no, billion-dollar question. The short answer is, there is no single identified cause of depression or depressive disorders. Depressive disorders develop due to genetic, environmental, and psychological factors. Genetically, monozygotic twins have a concordance rate for major depression of about 37%. This means that there is a genetic component for depression in some families. Adversity during childhood, such as trauma, low social support, neglect, and parental divorce, death, or mental illness, are often correlated with the onset of a depressive disorder. People with chronic or disabling medical conditions are also at increased risk for major depressive episodes. What sorts of anatomic changes do we see in the brain? Brain imaging studies of untreated depression show decreased frontal lobe and hippocampal volumes. And what about molecular changes? Well, certain neurotransmitter changes are associated with depression, such as decreased serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Reduced gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, transmission, remember, that's the inhibitor of neurotransmission in the central nervous system, and elevated levels of glutamate are also seen with depressive disorders. Luckily, because of the vast knowledge that we have on how neurotransmitters are affected in depressive disorders, developments in pharmacotherapy to help these patients are available. But we'll come back to this later in the episode. Okay, you know I can't go on to the next topic without quizzing you, so here goes. In patients with depression, what brain regions are most affected? The frontal lobe and hippocampi have been shown to decrease in volume in these patients. Part 4. How are depressive disorders diagnosed? All depressive disorders are marked by a sad, disinterested, or empty mood, along with an impaired ability to function in everyday life. However, they differ with regards to duration, onset, and etiology. As with other psychiatric disorders, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, or DSM-5, criteria are used for diagnosis. Let's begin with learning about major depressive disorder. Major depressive disorder is characterized by a period of either depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure. This loss in an ability to experience interest or pleasure is called anhedonia. These symptoms must last at least 2 weeks in major depressive disorder. Now, I'm emphasizing the timeline here because the duration of disease is used by the DSM-5 for diagnosis. This period must represent a change from previous functioning and cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social and occupational areas. One more thing, these symptoms cannot be attributable to the physiologic effects of substance use or to another medical condition. The patient must have either depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure. On top of that criteria, the patient must also have 5 or more symptoms from the Sig-E-CAPS mnemonic. Let's learn that mnemonic together because it will come up again and again. The Sig-E-CAPS mnemonic summarizes the symptoms criteria for diagnosing major depressive disorder. S stands for sleep, which can be increased or reduced. I stands for interest, which is decreased. G stands for guilt, such as a feeling of worthlessness. E stands for decreased energy. C is for decreased concentration. A is for appetite or weight changes. P is for psychomotor agitation or retardation. And finally, the S stands for suicidal ideation. So major depressive disorder symptoms, Sig-E-CAPS. Unfortunately, depression often goes unrecognized by primary care providers. In many cultures, somatic symptoms such as insomnia and fatigue are commonly the presenting complaint. Now let's see what you remember about the timeline of diagnosing major depressive disorder. For how long does a patient have to experience depressed mood or loss of interest in order to be diagnosed with major depressive disorder? The answer is at least 2 weeks. If depressed mood continues for a long period of time, it may be diagnosed as persistent depressive disorder. Persistent depressive disorder differs from major depressive disorder in both duration and severity. Persistent depressive disorder is characterized by depressed mood lasting at least 2 years. The depressed mood is present for most of the day, with no more than 2 symptom-free months in 1 year. Compare this with major depressive disorder's requirement lasting at least 2 weeks. In terms of depressive symptoms, remember that major depressive disorder requires at least 5 depressive symptoms. Persistent depressive disorder has a lower requirement, where the patient must have depressed or irritable mood along with at least 2 of the SIGE-CAP symptoms. Quick review time, everybody. How does persistent depressive disorder differ from major depressive disorder? Well, while major depressive disorder requires at least 5 depressive symptoms lasting for 2 weeks, persistent depressive disorder only requires 2 depressive symptoms lasting at least 2 years in adults. Let's turn our attention to disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, abbreviated DMDD. DMDD is characterized by an angry or irritable mood most of the day, with episodes of angry outbursts. While all kids lash out and have temper tantrums, these children are angry all the time. They exhibit severe physical and verbal aggression that is out of proportion to the situation, and which occurs in multiple settings. The age of onset for DMDD is usually before 10 years. Diagnosis cannot be made for the first time before the age of 6 or after the age of 18 years. Disruptive mood dysregulation disorder is a childhood diagnosis that is much more common in boys. According to DSM-5 criteria, DMDD outbursts need to occur at least 3 or more times per week, on average. Symptoms last for at least 12 months, where symptom-free periods cannot exceed 3 months in 1 year. Finally, symptoms must occur in at least 2 of the following settings: at home, in school, or among peers. So just to see if you were paying attention, how does a child with disruptive mood dysregulation disorder typically present? DMDD is characterized by angry or irritable mood most of the day, with episodes of angry outbursts occurring 3 or more times per week for at least 12 months. Let's switch gears. Have you ever heard of PMS? Yep, I'm talking about premenstrual syndrome, or the emotional and physical symptoms that occur before the start of each menstrual period in women. Up to 80% of women report some form of PMS. If you think that's bad, well, some patients have a severe form of PMS called premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Abbreviated as PMDD, it's characterized by symptoms that are so severe that they interfere with a patient's everyday functioning. The symptoms of PMDD are similar to those of major depressive disorder, but instead of depressed mood or anhedonia, patients must have either depressed mood, anxiety, sensitivity to rejection, or irritability. Additionally, patients with PMDD often complain of somatic symptoms like bloating, breast tenderness, and muscle aches or feeling overwhelmed, none of which are part of the diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder. Pop quiz time! How is premenstrual dysphoric disorder related to PMS? Premenstrual dysphoric disorder is a severe form of PMS, where symptoms interfere with the patient's everyday life and ability to function. Okay, so the disorders we have explored so far cannot be due to the physiological effects of a substance. But when a patient exhibits symptoms of depression after ingesting a substance capable of producing these symptoms, it's called substance or medication-induced depressive disorder. Such causes include alcohol, opiates, cocaine, amphetamines, and corticosteroids. Now, there are several DSM-5 criteria that need to be met to diagnose this disorder. First, patients must experience depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure soon after substance intoxication or withdrawal or after medication exposure. These symptoms also do not last long after exposure or withdrawal, typically on the order of 1 month. Then, symptoms in substance or medication-induced depressive disorder are not better explained by another depressive disorder and must not occur exclusively during delirium. If depressive symptoms can be due to taking certain substances or medications, can it be also due to another medical condition? The answer is yes, and no surprise, it's called depressive disorder due to another medical condition. With this disorder, the medical history exam and laboratory tests indicate that the mood disturbance is the result of some other medical condition. Possible causes include hypothyroidism, adrenal insufficiency, systemic lupus, and vitamin B12 insufficiency. Let's do a quick review on causes of depressive symptoms. Besides a primary depressive disorder, what are some other causes of depressive symptoms? Substance or medication-induced depressive disorder and depressive disorder due to another medical condition, such as hypothyroidism, can present in a patient with symptoms of depression. Now, I want to take a short tangent here to tell you there are several specifiers in the DSM-5 for depressive symptoms. Two important ones to mention here are the peripartum onset and with seasonal pattern. Peripartum onset is applied when major depressive episodes begin during pregnancy or in the 4 weeks after delivery, called the postpartum period. Peripartum onset mood episodes may present with or without psychotic features. The specifier seasonal pattern is used in recurrent major depressive disorder when there is a relationship between the major depressive episodes and the time of year. Part 5. Differential diagnoses in comorbid conditions. One important point to learn about depressive disorders is that the symptoms of depression may not be the primary cause. Depressive symptoms can also be part of other psychiatric disorders, such as bipolar disorder and cyclothymia. When depression presents with features such as hallucinations or delusions, it can be mistaken for schizophrenia. Depressive disorders are also frequently comorbid with other psychiatric disorders, including panic disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, substance-related disorders, anorexia or bulimia nervosa, and borderline personality disorder. Symptoms associated with disorders such as cancer, tuberculosis, and malabsorption syndrome may also be mistaken for depression. These diseases should all be on your differential diagnoses when you're thinking about the cause of depression. So you see, diagnosing depression or a specific depressive disorder is not always easy. It's not black and white and can be quite challenging. This is why it's crucial to get a full patient medical history, and even the physical exam will play a significant role in determining a primary depressive disorder or a comorbid condition. Part 6. How are depressive disorders assessed and treated? Because depressive symptoms can be part of other psychiatric disorders, a thorough medical history, physical exam, and psychiatric evaluation are necessary for an accurate diagnosis and to develop an appropriate treatment plan. How do depressive disorders typically present? Well, patients with depression may present with vague physical symptoms, such as difficulty concentrating or low energy. Medical causes of low energy, such as hypothyroidism, weight loss, such as cancer or tuberculosis, and other symptoms should be ruled out first. Because depression can be a side effect of many common medications, such as beta blockers, birth control, proton pump inhibitors, and benzodiazepines, it is important to ask about medication use. It is also important to specifically ask about suicidal thoughts or actions. And one key point here, asking about suicide does not increase the patient's risk of attempting or completing the act. In the elderly, patients with depression can present with cognitive impairment, such as memory loss or slowed speech. These symptoms are sometimes mistaken for dementia. When the cognitive decline in depression resembles dementia, this is called pseudo-dementia. What exactly is pseudo-dementia? It's not a diagnosis, but rather a description. And unlike dementia, cognitive impairment and pseudo-dementia due to depression may be reversible. Question time. What is pseudo-dementia? Pseudo-dementia describes cognitive decline in the elderly that resembles dementia, but is due to underlying depression. Let's do a quick review of what we discussed so far. We learned about the epidemiology of depressive disorders and described several major types of depressive disorders, including major depressive disorder, persistent depressive disorder, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder in children, premenstrual dysphoric disorder in women, and also other comorbid conditions. How do we help and treat patients with depressive disorders? First, we'll start with pharmacologic treatments. To think about why we give specific medications for depression, it's important to think about the neurotransmitters affected in the disease. Depression is associated with several neurotransmitter changes, including decreased serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Therefore, the first-line drugs for depression are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. This drug class, which includes fluoxetine, paroxetine, and sertraline, works by increasing serotonin levels by preventing reuptake. Other drug classes include serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, which increase levels of both serotonin and norepinephrine. Tricyclic antidepressants also increase serotonin levels and can be used to treat depression. So in terms of pharmacotherapy, what is the first-line medication for major depression? The first-line medication for major depression is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI, such as fluoxetine, paroxetine, or sertraline. Another drug class for treating depression is monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or MAOIs. These prevent the metabolism of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. However, monoamine oxidase inhibitors also prevent the breakdown of the molecule tyramine, which is found in cheese, processed meat, and pickled or smoked fish. And why do we care about this part of the mechanism? Because when patients take monoamine oxidase inhibitors, consume tyramine-rich foods, the tyramine is absorbed into the general circulation. It then displaces monoamines such as dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine from presynaptic vesicles. The result is a hypertensive crisis, defined as a systolic blood pressure greater than 180 millimeters of mercury or a diastolic blood pressure greater than 120 millimeters of mercury. Think of this emergency when you see a patient on monoamine oxidase inhibitors who eats a diet heavy in cheese and processed meats. Are there other antidepressant medication choices? Yes, there are. Other antidepressants include atypical drugs such as bupropion, mirtazapine, and trazodone. Bupropion has the added benefit of being able to help treat nicotine dependence and has a lower rate of sexual dysfunction as a side effect. However, it may cause weight loss, so it should be avoided in patients with eating disorders. Mirtazapine causes sedation and weight gain, which makes it useful in depressed patients with insomnia or weight loss. Trazodone can be used to treat insomnia as well as depression. What about pregnant women? Should we worry about giving antidepressants to women who are pregnant or breastfeeding? Women with postpartum major depression can take antidepressants, even if they are breastfeeding, because the benefits of the medication outweigh the low risk to the infant. Pharmacotherapy is usually combined with psychotherapy for greater efficacy in treating depression. The foremost psychotherapy used is cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which focuses on changing a person's thinking patterns. This therapy involves clinical sessions and self-directed exercises. Many studies have shown that when CBT is combined with antidepressants, the treatment is more effective than using either therapy alone. What do we do in cases of depression where the patient is high risk? In these cases, electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, may be used. ECT is a procedure that involves producing a generalized seizure under anesthesia. ECT can be used as first-line treatment for depression in urgent situations such as high suicide risk, malnutrition, dehydration, or a refusal to eat. ECT can also be used in depression refractory to pharmacologic treatment. Finally, transcranial magnetic stimulation can also be used to treat depression. It is as effective as medications, but less effective than ECT. All right, final pop quiz about psychotherapy. What is the most common type of psychotherapy used in treating depression? Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is used and is often combined with antidepressants. So that's all for depressive disorders today. Let's see if we've completed our goal for this episode. First, what do the depressive disorders have in common, and which populations are at high risk? Depressive disorders are characterized by depressed mood, like feelings of sadness or guilt, or loss of interest in activities to a degree that impairs daily functioning. While depression is less common with advancing age, older adults who are hospitalized or receive home health care are at an increased risk for depression. Second, can you describe the causes of depression? The causes of depressive disorders are multifactorial, including genetics, environmental, and psychological influences. Anatomically, patients with depression have been shown to have decreased volume in their frontal lobe and hippocampal regions. On a molecular level, depression is associated with decreased serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, and GABA transmission, as well as elevated levels of glutamate. Next, can you name the diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder? Major depressive disorder is where a patient experiences depressed mood for at least 2 weeks, along with at least 5 or more symptoms of SIGE-CAPS. Remember that SIGE-CAPS stands for sleep, interest, guilt, energy, concentration, appetite, psychomotor changes, and suicidal ideation. Now, how do persistent depressive disorder, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, and premenstrual dysphoric disorder differ from major depressive disorder? Persistent depressive disorder differs from major depressive disorder because it must last at least 2 years in adults with at least 2 of the SIGE-CAPS symptoms. Disruptive mood dysregulation disorder presents in children and is characterized by angry or irritable mood most of the day, with at least 3 or more angry outbursts per week for 12 months. Premenstrual dysphoric disorder is a severe form of PMS, where symptoms interfere with a person's daily functions. Now, can you name the differential diagnoses and comorbid conditions for depressive disorders? In depressive disorder due to another medical condition, diseases such as hypothyroidism, adrenal insufficiency, lupus, and vitamin B12 insufficiency can cause depressive symptoms. The differential for depressive disorders include other psychiatric conditions such as bipolar disorder, cyclothymic disorder, and schizophrenia, as well as medical disorders such as cancer, tuberculosis, and malabsorption syndrome. Finally, how would you treat depressive disorders? A thorough medical history, physical exam, and psychiatric evaluation are necessary for an accurate diagnosis and to develop an appropriate treatment plan. The most common psychotherapy is cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is usually paired with antidepressants to increase treatment efficacy. The first-line medication for major depression is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI. In patients who have depression and are high risk, electroconvulsive therapy may be used. Now, with our new understanding of depressive disorders, let's get back to that case from the very beginning. A 29-year-old female patient presents to your clinic for an annual checkup, and you notice that she appears fatigued and downcast. You become concerned that she meets criteria for a major depressive episode. What other questions would you ask? What next steps would you recommend? Thinking back to what you know about depression in SIGE-CAPS, you note that this patient already fulfills two criteria for major depressive disorder, that is, feelings of guilt and decreased energy. You ask the patient about any sleep and appetite changes, loss of interest and concentration, and you ask your patient if she has ever had thoughts of hurting herself. "Oh no," she responds, "I would never do that, but I haven't been eating as much and I've lost sleep." She reveals that she has had difficulty concentrating on small assignments at work, and she is no longer interested in hanging out with friends. Although this patient meets the diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder, you need to be diligent and consider other possible causes and also comorbid conditions. You ask about family history of depression, and if the patient has had any prior manic symptoms in order to rule out bipolar disorder, which she does not. Nor does she take other medications, OCPs, or other substances. You order a thyroid panel, cortisol panel, and vitamin B12 levels, which all return normal. Only after you have ruled out potential other comorbidities and causes do you diagnose this patient with depression. At a follow-up appointment, you discuss medication options with her. You explain SSRIs and tell her that fluoxetine may improve her sleep quality, her appetite, and her mood. She will follow up with you in 4 to 6 weeks, and you anticipate that she will feel some amount of improvement by that time. She agrees to contact you immediately if she develops any new or worrisome symptoms, such as suicidal thoughts. And that's our show for today. Make sure to like and subscribe. Your feedback continuously helps us to improve. You can get the full RxBricks experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, study questions, flashcards, and active learning. Happy studying, and until next time, see you soon.